So the image, by the way, that you see behind us here is a 1912 painting by Marc Chagall called The Fiddler. And Yael is there. She is. She was telling me when she found it recently to use for this that it reportedly gave the name to the Fiddler on the Roof musical. So it has, of course, some significance in the conversation about exile and diaspora that we're having today. So today I'm delighted to introduce Professor Alan Wolfe. He's the founding director of this center and professor of political science here at Boston College. He's the author or editor of more than 20 books, most recently Political Evil, How It Is and How to Combat It, but also other well-known books, The Future of Liberalism, The Transformation of American Religion, One Nation After All, etc. And he's at work on a new book that he's speaking about today called The Blessings of Exile, Why Minority Status is Good for the Jews and Everyone Else. He has taught at a number of universities before BC, including Boston University, where he's a university professor and was a dean at the New School for Social Science Research. And he's been a visiting professor at Aarhus in Denmark and Harvard University and a fellow at the American Academy in Berlin. And he's been thinking about these issues for a very long time. So it's a special pleasure to have you speak for us, Alan, and the table is all yours.
Thank you. Well, it's a great honor to be invited to speak at the Boston Center. I've always wanted to do this. Well, whenever people talk about Jews, Jewish history, especially, there's an inevitable tendency to divide Jews into two camps. The particularists who are primarily believe that Jews should be primarily concerned with their own, and the universalists who believe that Jews are under a special mission to repair the world, to take the fate of everyone into consideration and not just the fate of the Jews. Now, this particularism, universalism dichotomy is one of those vast generalizations that terribly oversimplifies anything and that no scholar of Jewish studies would accept. I accept it completely. I think it tells us a great deal. And moreover, I don't think anyone can refrain from using it. Particularism has very, very strong roots in Jewish theology. It really emerges out of a reading of the Bible and especially the book of Deuteronomy, that the dispersion or the exile, you call it whatever you want, the spreading of Jews around the world was God's punishment for their sins, that the Jews made God angry and God was punishing them for that. And it really contributed to a feeling that Jews would never be at home and never be completely comfortable in societies in which they were inevitably going to be a minority, and they had to think much more self-protectively about themselves. I would just broadly generalize that particularism came in two kinds of forms. One, that Jews were simply superior to everybody else and therefore didn't need to be concerned with others. And the other, that Jews were simply indifferent to everyone else. The Jewish superiority is rooted in the ideas of one of the greatest poets in the Jewish tradition, Yehuda Halevi, of classical Golden Age Spain, who was a physician as well as a poet, and in his masterpiece really argued that Jews were simply genetically superior to everyone else. God made his chosen people better. As a result, he frowned upon conversion. No one with inferior genes should be allowed to convert, and so on. That's a pretty harsh form of particularism. The greatest of the Jewish theologians, Maimonides, held to a similar idea of Jewish supremacy, Jewish superiority, but not genetically based. Maimonides was simply convinced that the Jewish tradition, and especially its invention of the concept of monotheism and its understanding of the law as handed down through the Torah, was better than other efforts, and that unlike Halevi, Maimonides would be okay with the notion of someone from another faith converting to the more superior one. Why not? But when he talked about non-Jewish religions, he used words like pagan and heathen and so on. Universalism also has theological roots. It's also based upon a reading of some of the same passages in the Bible. But universalists believe that the dispersion, the exile, the diaspora, was God's way of informing his chosen people that they would be spread around the world to bring ideas of Jewish concern and Jewish charity to everyone. That the notion of tikkun olam, of repairing the world, was essential to the Jewish understanding of themselves, and that consequently Jews should be concerned with the fate of all and not just with the fate of the Jews. Universalism has very early roots, but it really flourished and came to life in its modern form in mid-19th century German Reformed Judaism. Rabbis like David Einhorn, who was born in Bavaria, was probably the most preeminent German Reformed Jewish rabbi of the 19th century, who formulated a whole series of ideas. Jews were not superior to others, that the Jewish obligation was not to convert anyone else, but to show and learn that religions could learn from each other. He wrote extensively that the many of the laws that are viewed by the particularists as binding and eternal were actually customs developed in particular times and places, such as women sitting or not even being allowed in the synagogue, but sitting in a different section, and that those things could be easily abolished, in fact had to be abolished, to preserve what was essential about Judaism. German Reformed Judaism migrated to the United States. In fact, David Einhorn migrated to the United States. He assumed the leadership of a synagogue in Baltimore just in the years before the outbreak of the Civil War. In his first sermon at that synagogue, he denounced slavery and this in a border state, and he was removed from his position. His two sons married both Reform rabbis. Both married Reform rabbis who became among the most important Reform rabbis in American history. Both were contributors to the so-called Pittsburgh Platform, which was a representative of German Reform Judaism in the United States. Among other things, the Pittsburgh Platform condemned Zionism and thought that the creation of a Jewish state would be a serious mistake because it would reflect a form of nationalism and that all forms of nationalism are to be condemned, including Jewish nationalism, because Jews were a universalistic people. Pittsburgh Platform was eventually repudiated by Reformed Jews in Columbus, Ohio, a number of years later. Jews in Pittsburgh, Jews in Columbus. I love it. Goodbye, Columbus is the title of one of the greatest works of fiction by a Jewish writer. One of the arguments of my book is that of these two traditions, the past 50 years, 60 or 70 years, in fact, almost, I was born in 1942, so in the years that I've been alive, particularism has totally triumphed over universalism for a fairly obvious reason, and I think an inevitable reason, and that is that the two great events of the 20th century with respect to the Jews, and the two really most important events in all of Jewish history, 3,000 or 4,000 years old, depending on how you count, were the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. They occurred one right after the other. Holocaust Memorial Day in Israel and Israeli Independence Day are 1 week apart. The two are inevitably linked, and the two are inevitably particularistic. Hitler, of course, was the greatest particularist of all time. He wanted to kill Jews because they were Jews. He didn't care where they were from. He didn't care what their occupation was. He wanted to kill them all. He did kill other people as well, so I guess you can't call him entirely a particularist in that sense. He went after gypsies and so on, but and homosexuals. But he was totally preoccupied with the Jews. Exterminating the Jews is a way of being particularistic about them. But also, Israel was inevitably particularistic. I mean, as different as they were, one seeking to destroy the Jews and the other seeking to protect them, both focused on Jews. Israel needed Jews to live there. Just as Hitler needed Jews to kill. When those two events took place, when the war ends in 1945 and Israel is created exactly 3 years later in 1948, how could it not be that the two of them would be linked? The highly prolific Jewish writer and rabbi Jacob Neusner calls the combination of the Holocaust and the creation of Israel the great civil religion of contemporary Jewry, and particularly American and diasporic Jewry, that a civil religion creates essentially a secular but nonetheless overarching explanation of why we're here and what we live for, and destruction and salvation then become inevitably linked. The world will destroy the Jews, Israel can save the Jews. The two sort of go together. And really, how could they not? I mean, these were events of titanic significance. And so I don't think it could really be otherwise. As long as those two events dominated Jewish consciousness, both in Israel and in the diaspora, and as long as they were this civil religion, a number of things followed, or a number of things accompanied the particularism that grew out of it. There was the great fear of assimilation, for example, or what was defined in what's often called the golden age of American Jewry, the years from 1950 to the years that really preceded and followed Israel's 1967 war, the golden age of American Jewry. The fear was of what people at the time called Jewish continuity, that if anti-Semitism failed to kill all the Jews, assimilation would do the same thing. In fact, rabbis, especially particularistic rabbis, made all kinds of correlations. Some said that assimilation was worse than Hitler. I have a series of quotes in the book about, you know, how awful assimilation was, that there wouldn't be any Jews left. One Harvard demographer, I don't know his name on top of him, wrote an article saying that by the 2076, what would that be, the tricentennial of the founding of the United States, there would be precisely 26,500 Jews left in America. But his colleague at the law school, Alan Dershowitz, went in better and said that by that year there would be no Jews anywhere outside of Israel. So you get these predictions that diaspora essentially means death, and combination of anti-Semitism and assimilation. That's essential, I think, to this kind of particularistic outlook on the world. Fear of assimilation, and of course the fear of anti-Semitism, which goes along with it. I mean, they would seem to be sort of opposites. In one, the anti-Semites want to kill the Jews, and in the other, assimilation, they want to marry the Jews. And it's hard to sort of imagine both killing and marrying. Oh, maybe it's not so hard to imagine. I knew you'd like that. But these were the twin threats that particularism took. I have one chapter in the book which I kind of like more than some of the others, about how while particularism became enormously strong in this area, it also severed entirely its theological and religious roots. It was entirely secular. I'm particularly fascinated by the man called the founder or the godfather of neoconservatism in the United States, Irvin Kristol. Neoconservatism is widely viewed as being apologists for Israel. Kristol was not a Zionist, believe it or not. For one thing, Kristol celebrated the diaspora, celebrated the triumph of Jews in America, denounced the idea that Jews were being threatened by anti-Semitism. In that, he was much more in line with, or he never accepted the idea that Jews inevitably would have to move to Israel to protect themselves. He thought that they were completely flourishing in the United States. He also understood that, at least in its early years, Israel was widely viewed as a socialist or social democratic state. And as a conservative, he wanted nothing to do with that side of Israel as well. He actually never wrote about Zionism. He never mentioned any of the Zionist writers in all of his writings. He never mentioned Jewish theologians, Maimonides, Halevi. The leading Orthodox Jewish theologian in the United States wrote an article highly critical of Kristol for not knowing anything about the Talmud and the Talmudic tradition. Entirely secular. Jews should protect themselves not because they're the chosen people, or they should just be self-defensive ethnic group like almost any other. So particularism lost what was particular about the Jews. The Jews became just like everyone else, like Italians trying to protect themselves. And so its great triumph was also the moment that it began to weaken, because it no longer had any particular way of inspiring people. Whatever one thinks of religion, there's something inspirational about it. When it turned into a much more secular form, I think it became time-bound. It lost any sense of eternity, that it was produced by specific events, and events change. And indeed, the two events that did so much to found this tradition of particularism, the creation of Israel and the Holocaust, both changed as well. The Holocaust is increasingly receding. Now, you may think in people's memories, it no longer dominates the way it once did. You may think this is a bad idea. There's one extremely particularistic Jewish professor at the University of Indiana named Alvin Rosenfeld, who wrote a book saying, we're losing the Holocaust. The Holocaust is now taken as a metaphor for the sufferings of all people. And what a terrible thing this is. The Holocaust was about the Jews, and we got to keep it to be about the Jews. And inevitably, I think that way of thinking loses its attractiveness. The Holocaust was probably the worst genocide, but it doesn't mean it was the only genocide. And other genocides happen. And in this context of thinking about all people, this, you know, that Jews have to somehow remind the world that they're the only victims, just increasingly loses its appeal. And I think it really has. The victimization also, it means that you have to deny everything that Jews have ever done, because if you admit that Jews have ever been successful in diaspora, you're undermining the whole concept of them needing special protection. At one point, I compare the writings of Harvard professor of Yiddish, Ruth Weiss, who's also a neoconservative, with Crystal. And whereas Crystal celebrates the diaspora, Ruth Weiss is much more the traditional particularist. No, they can't. I mean, she wrote a book about called Jews in Power and never mentioned that at least 2.5 prime ministers of France were Jewish. Never mentioned the success of Jews in politics anywhere. It just doesn't appear in her book because it's an argument for the inevitable weakness of Jews in the diaspora. So these, I think, especially the younger Jews, however Jewish they are, these are not attractive ideas anymore. And Israel, of course, has changed as well since 1948. It's obviously no longer anything like socialist or left-wing. It's become much more militaristic, and I don't necessarily mean that to be pejorative, but just purely descriptive. Zionism, as I'm sure a lot of you know, began in Europe as a thoroughly secular movement. It still is to some degree. Benjamin Netanyahu is not at all a religious man, but of course he's formed an alliance with ultra-religious, ultra-right-wing religious parties, which is very, very disturbing to a lot of people who don't like their treatment of women and don't like their ideas about society in general. So particularism is really, really in danger. In fact, I think it's already halfway on the path of losing its appeal. And so my book ends with a description of a number of much more universalistically inclined movements. I pay particular importance to European Jewry. Roughly speaking, there are 6 million Jews in Israel, 6 million Jews in the United States, and 1 million Jews in Europe, including an astonishing 100,000 who live in Germany by choice, pretty much. American Jews, so powerful, so strong, so proud to be of their accomplishments, are, in a sense, have become very, very strongly established. European Jews who are politically much weaker are more like a diaspora within the diaspora. They're in exile both from Israel and from the United States. Europe is also where the Holocaust happened, and it's also where the Enlightenment happened. And so there are two traditions that Europeans can turn to that are thoroughly European. So I have a lot about some of the revivals of universalistic Judaism in Europe. This comes as a shock to many Jews who think that France is the most anti-Semitic country in the world, who point out the revival of anti-Semitism in countries like Hungary, where my grandparents came from. And it's true, I certainly wouldn't claim that anti-Semitism has disappeared or even will ever disappear. But this relentless focus, I think, and especially the identification of Muslims as determined to exterminate Jews in Europe, is a wild oversimplification of the actual realities, and I want to address that in the conclusion of the book. But I don't think it's hopeless in the United States either. I think there's an awful lot churning under the surface of the establishment, and even the most established Jews are now talking about what they call non-establishment Judaism and seeing among younger people something that is really so totally different than the Judaism of their parents and their grandparents. So that's the overview, and thanks for paying attention. And I think I got most of it in there.
Yeah, thank you.